Hello, and welcome to the Classicist podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. So, Victor, one of our first shows of 2020, presidential election year, and we'll turn to politics for the first time this year, because you have already called your shot. You had a piece in The Spectator entitled Why Trump Will Win Again in 2020, and this is why you occupy a distinctive place amongst American intellectuals. Your argument for this begins on a bike path in rural Michigan. This was one of your leading indicators in 2016. You're keeping an eye on it again. Explain what you've seen there and why it stood out to you.
Well, I've been there teaching there for 15 years, the month of September, and so I watched the 2004, 8, 12, and 16 election. And 16 election was the first time I saw people energized in rural Michigan. And that was important because that was a state that was going to matter. And Trump won it by about 10,000 votes. And rural Michigan, like northern Ohio, were ex-Perot voters. I guess we call them Tea Party voters, blue-collar workers. I don't know what the term is, but they did not come out and vote for John McCain and Mitt Romney. And that was clear when I was there. They had no interest at all. And this time, in 2020, they seem to be just like 2016. I'd stop and talk to people. They were very pro-Trump. You would think that because it's a farming area, they were worried about China. They were not. And that piece, I've been as well traveling the San Joaquin Valley, so I'm kind of obnoxious. I drive here across California from the Bay Area to the Central California. It's about 190 miles, and I take different routes. And I stop at gas stations, I stop at quick stops, I stop at coffee shops, and talk to people. And most of them are Mexican-American. I would say about a third of them, maybe higher than a third, are going to vote for Donald Trump. Won't matter in California, but in these swing states that have 250,000, 500,000 Hispanic voters, first and second generation, it will matter. And then all of the classical data that we always, the analytics that we always look at. How did Trump do in his first midterm? Well, he lost 40 seats and picked up 2 Senate seats. Obama lost, I think it was 62 House seats, and he lost 6 Senate, and Clinton lost 8 Senate and lost 52. So he did as well or better. The Real Clear Politics average has him about a point behind where Obama was at this point. And as he was looking at reelection campaign, he's from about where Clinton was in the Gallup poll in 1996 in January. So that looks good. And then the three events that destroy second terms or convince presidents not to run again. Unpopular wars. He's been pretty good about not wanting to get in to the Middle East on the ground, and he wants to get out of Afghanistan. As far as scandal, he survived the Mueller. I think the Horowitz report is a precursor to John Durham's report. So I think he's done pretty well there. The impeachment was botched by the Democrats, and it's booming rank. They don't have 51% as they used to have to go ahead with it. So I don't see a scandal. And then the key thing is the economy. And it's very hard to have a recession when you have 3.5, 3.6 unemployment, and real workers' wages have been going up 3% per annum. Inflation is low. Interest rates are low. Stock market is high. Housing market is good. So if we're going to have a recession, I think it's going to be after the election. Put all that together, and there's one final ingredient. It's not a popularity contest. He's running against somebody. And the more we hear from Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren, we don't see a moderate Democrat. Even Michael Bloomberg is disowning a lot of his prior policies and initiatives. So I think Trump was going
to
win.
This brings me to the next point that I wanted to raise, because you've mentioned a few times in the course of Trump's first term that you saw the potential for the Democrats to go sort of McGovern in 72 and nominate someone way to the left of the electorate. So you and I are having this conversation a few weeks before the Iowa caucuses. I think we can reasonably say that there are 4, maybe 5 candidates with a plausible shot at the Democratic nomination. 2 of those, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, clearly fit that McGovernite profile. The 2 others, Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, portray themselves as closer to the center. Walk me through how you see the dynamics in the primaries and how you think these potential candidates square up against Trump.
Well, you know, I think so far in the last year, it's been a referendum on the progressive AOC wing of the Democratic Party. And from what we've seen, for all the talk about identity politics, the voters did not want Cory Booker. They did not want Castro. They did not want Kamala Harris. They did not want a whole slew of harder left candidates. They don't want Tom Steyer. So what do they want? They want someone that can beat Trump. And they want someone that they know is not crazy. And that's not true of Sanders or Warren. So it's the fact that they're even looking at Buttigieg and Biden as a commentary because they're both flawed candidates. Mayor Pete's had no experience except pretty much mismanaging a city of about 100,000 people. And he hasn't had any political experience. He's moved far to the left. And Biden, people are, I think the Democrats are, they're, the voter says we have to go with Biden, and they have a suspension of disbelief. So when he doesn't know where he is, or he misspeaks, or he renounces his prior centrist record, or he says he wants to take Trump behind the gym, or he brags about beating somebody up, they just say, you know what? It's sort of like Trump supporters. I've already baked that into the Biden candidacy, just like they baked Stormy Daniels into the Trump candidacy. And, you know, Action Hollywood and all that, Access Hollywood and all that stuff. So they've baked in the fact that Joe Biden is not a healthy 76-year-old, and he will be an even less healthy 77-year-old. And they know that he's going to flub. They know he's going to get confused. They know he's going to slur his words, and they don't care because in their way of thinking, they have no other alternative. Sort of like 2016 with Hillary Clinton. They know she was a flawed candidate. They know she wasn't healthy. They know she could misspeak in disastrous ways. And yet they thought, you know what? I don't care. This is a way to perpetuate the Obama 8 years. And they were wrong then. I think they're wrong now.
When you're considering the contours of this election, there is a dog that didn't bark factor because there is a faction of the Republican Party that remains implacably opposed to the president. And yet there is no real primary challenge. You've got Bill Weld and Joe Walsh both running campaigns that I think could generously be described as marginal. Mark Sanford was doing the same thing for a bit before he dropped out. So there's been all this fraternal squabbling over Donald Trump within the Republican Party. And yet not only is there not a real threat to his renomination, there's not even a particularly significant symbolic candidacy against him. To what do you attribute that?
Well, it's obviously, there's two reasons. One is that the never Trump conservative-Republican complaint against him was that he was a liberal in conservative sheep's clothing, a liberal wolf, and he wasn't. So by any data on what conservatives do when they're presidents, whether it's deregulation or energy production or judicial picks or economic policy or foreign policy, he's been different, but he's not a liberal. And then second is that everybody from Paul Krugman to Larry Summers said he was going to tank the economy, and we hadn't had an economy like this in 40 years. So the never Trumpers then, who told us he's a liberal and he's going to ruin the economy, were wrong. And then there was a sort of an adding insult to injury. Most of their positions that they'd spent their entire lives embracing, I'm talking about people like David Frum or Max Boot or George Will, deterrence abroad or being tough friends of Israel or being tough on our adversaries or complaining against what China's doing, but not doing much about it. Trump did exactly what they have always wanted. They didn't like the Iran deal. They always told us you could move the capital to Jerusalem and nothing would happen. A lot of them wanted to cut the Palestinians off. They said we're never going to give back the Golan Heights to Syria. They told us all this stuff. And so this orange guy with the weird hair from and the Queen's accent comes and does exactly what they want. And they hate him not because of what he does, but because who he is. And so everybody looks at him and they said, you guys were insincere. And then when you look at their, I don't look at them often, but if you look at their venues, the Bulwark or the Dispatch, they're orphaned. They have no constituency, because if you want to read anti-Trump stuff, you might as well get the real thing from the left. And yet they're basically saying Trump is wrong because he's embracing a position that I used to advocate, and therefore it's been polluted and I can no longer have my fingerprints. And I don't think anybody wants to read that stuff.
You've made the point on multiple occasions, including in your book, The Case for Trump, that we really couldn't have every presidency look like Donald Trump's. Yeah. And I think about some of the analogies that you've used. Trump as chemotherapy. It's rough and it's aggressive, but it's also severe enough to take out the underlying malady. Trump as a Western hero like Shane, who's there to perform a vital function, even if it's not fully appreciated. And what these analogies have in common is a sense that this is sort of ephemeral, that this will be a sort of sui generis presidency. But I wonder what in particular you think is unique to Trump and what may have more staying power, because he's not just different stylistically. It's also on some areas of substance. Yes. The Republican Party, at least its leadership, we should probably make that distinction, was allergic to protectionism before Trump. It was a bit more internationalist on foreign policy. It was much less aggressive on illegal immigration than Trump has been. So what are the parts of the Trump legacy that you think endure within the GOP, and what are the parts that you suspect leave the office with him?
Well, you're absolutely right. You can't, as brilliant as Curtis LeMay or George Patton were, you can't create a military around those people in the sense of the establishment. And I think at the end of The Magnificent Seven, Yul Brynner turns to Steve McQueen and says, "We lose, we always lose," as they leave, because they're not the type of people you build a society around. But when you need somebody to clean up the banditos, you don't want a bureaucrat. And so I think Trump, his style, nobody says, none of his supporters say, we want every president to tweet and to talk like Trump. But most of them then would say, maybe privately, at this time and this place and on this occasion, we needed somebody to tell those people what we think of them. And he did the job. And as long as he's there, we're going to support him for doing that. And then, as you say, on positions, he tweaked the Republican and positions. And I think what he did was he looked at Republican ideology, free market ideology, borders, manufacturing, and he said, you know, they believe there's some natural force that in eventuality will make everything nice. By that I mean, just as a personal anecdote, I remember when I was going broke farming, we had gotten $1,400 a ton in raisins. The proto-EU suddenly started subsidizing European raisins and dumping them on the market, and the price dropped to $1,000 a ton, which meant, that we were getting $80,000 in income rather than $400,000 with $300,000 experience. And a guy came out from the Reagan administration, and he met all of us farmers, and he said, "This is good." We said, "What?" He said, "Europe's not paying their NATO fair share. We were supporting Europe, and they're subsidized. They destroyed our industry." He said, "Well, it's going to make you lean and mean. You're going to find a way to make raisins at $400. And you know what? They're not going to be able to sustain that $800 a ton subsidy. And you're going to be more efficient. And some of you are going to go broke that needed to go broke, creative destruction." And you looked at all these guys in their 70s that had been doing it for 50 years. And the little twerp that was telling, and everybody got angry about it. I thought, wow, I don't like Democrats, but that's why I didn't register as a Republican. And so I think Trump is telling the nation the free market's the only thing that worked, but there's winners and losers, and we're going to worry about the losers more than the winners in human terms. And he looked at the border and he said it wasn't just the Democratic left and the identity politics advocates who wanted to change the demography of the United States. It was employers and corporations who wanted cheap labor to drive down the wages of Americans and make them superfluous. And so that was a new message. And then with China, he really said, you know, the Republicans thought, as did the Democrats, that the more you appease China, the more they would be successful. The more they were successful, the more they would get wealthy. The more they got wealthy, the more they would be, you know, like Palo Alto, eventually liberalized politically and socially and culturally. That didn't happen. Trump comes in and said, they're cheating. They think you're an idiot. They have no respect for you. All that turned out to be true. And that was a lot of people in the Republican Party were making a lot of money in China. And so Trump He redefined our relationship with China. And then finally, the big thing was he said to the Republican Party, when I say endless wars, that's a synonym for Middle East wars. And so I'm speaking as a person who supported the removal of Saddam Hussein. But, you know, after a while, 18 years in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria and Libya, and people are saying to themselves, we don't like this place. I don't want to hear the names Zaghari, Zawahiri, bin Laden, Baghdadi, Soleimani. I'm sick of all that. And I'm sick of death to America in the street. I'm sick of spending billions of dollars rebuilding the power grid in Iraq. I don't want to do it anymore. And then they're looking at reasons, say, you have to do it. And they can't give them any. Israel's stronger than it ever was. And it's allied with the Arab moderate regime. So it's an oil and gas self-sufficient power. Now it's going to be an exporter. So they can't hurt Israel with the fuel. Then they look at us and they think, wow, we're the largest producer of oil and gas in the world. Who wants to go through the Strait of Hormuz? China, our trade enemy, they get 40%. And then they look at the Europeans. The Europeans say, you got to keep the sea lanes open. And we say, well, wait a minute. You've got more natural gas than we do, but you won't frack. And you won't build a navy to protect your own resources. And so they're desperate for an intellectual or an establishment or bureaucratic answer to why we should get the hell out of there. And they can't find any. When I get the hell out of here, I don't mean just turn your back and run. What I'm saying is most Americans and Trump have taught the country, most Americans agree with Trump, I should say, that we only have two objectives in the Middle East. We don't want any one power to use the oil wealth to build a nuclear weapon that's unstable like Iran or Saddam or Bashar Assad. And two, we don't want to have an enclave like Al-Qaeda created or ISIS did. Other than that, live and let live or live and let die, whatever it is. And I think Trump has won that issue. And I can't think of a Marco Rubio running for president in 4 years with a kitchen cabinet of Bob Kagan and David Frum and people saying, you know what, we've got to go in there and we've got to take out this particular country and we've got to... I just don't think that's ever going to happen again.
All right. You've been listening to The Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com and follow him on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.